Welcome to the GRF On The Go podcast. The subject matter experts at GRF CPAs and Advisors created this podcast to offer insights on current topics, as well as new ideas and best practices that your team can apply today. This podcast was originally presented as a live webinar. CPE information provided during the podcast is no longer valid, but if you're interested in watching the video version of this session or accessing the slide deck, visit our website at grfcpa.com/events. Enjoy the episode and remember to subscribe for future content.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to, and thanks for participating in the webinar today. This is the 2024 update on retirement plans. My name is Susan Colliday, and I'm an audit partner here at GRF. Joining me today are three of my colleagues, Alejandra Jensen, Mac Lillard, and Sarah Glenn. We're thrilled to share our knowledge and experience about retirement plans with you today. GRF is headquartered in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan region, and we're a full-service professional services firm providing clients with accounting, tax, and advisory solutions. For more than 40 years, the firm has supported the financial and operational success of for-profit and tax-exempt organizations locally, nationally, and around the world. As you can see by our list of topics today, we have a lot of great content to cover. So I am going to turn it over to Mac Lillard, who will take on the first topic, DOL cyber best practices. Mac, you have the microphone and the control.
Thank you very much, Susan. And yes, thank you for the honor of kicking things off today with everyone's favorite topic of cybersecurity best practices. For anybody who has joined us in the past for our retirement plan update, a lot of this information will probably look pretty familiar. And that is because there haven't been significant changes since these requirements were rolled out in 2021. So just as a little bit of a refresher, the DOL and the EBSA are currently in the process of conducting studies on cybersecurity related requirements to retirement plans to kind of delineate between the responsibilities of management and the service providers of the plan administrators that you may engage with. So currently, there's no formal guidance on what they would expect as far as minimum requirements or as far as a particular framework that you're required to be in compliance with. What we typically recommend to our clients and the frameworks that we most commonly see amongst our clients are the standard COSO 2013 framework, NIST CSF 2.0, and ISO 27001. So those are some of the more popular frameworks that we see. We also typically see blends of frameworks. So again, making sure that whatever is appropriate for your organization and your context will help to kind of steer that decision. But just for some high-level guidance, NIST CFS is typically used for U.S.-based nonprofits or government contractors. COSO is also pretty common for U.S.-based organizations, very common for not-for-profits. And ISO 27001 is typically used for international organizations or INGOs. But again, using a blend of those frameworks or even incorporating different frameworks from COBIT or CIS might be appropriate for your organization. So again, doing a baseline assessment to understand what framework might be best for you is always very important. But since the DOL doesn't actually prescribe a particular framework, they really use these tools as a basis to ask for more cybersecurity related information when they conduct their plan audits. And since they have issued these guidelines, the DOL is increasingly expressing interest in gathering information from these audited plans related to documentation over policies, procedures, and guidelines related to cybersecurity. So again, at a high level, management and the plan administrators are the ones responsible for ensuring plan compliance and for the administration of the plan, even if this is outsourced to a third-party institution. The onus falls on the employer. So it is up to the employer, again, to establish a basic or baseline internal controls for the organization to follow. So I've included some resources here below. I believe the slide deck will be distributed after this, so you'll have these hyperlinks to view these resources. I'm going to spend some time really going through in detail these cybersecurity program best practices on these next couple of slides, but the online security tips is extremely helpful for some basic policies, practices, best practices around managing access controls, password parameters, account creation and termination, if your beneficiaries or your plan participants are accessing their retirement accounts online. There's also tips for hiring a service provider if opening a retirement plan is a new process or a new concept for you, or if you're considering switching providers. Tips for hiring a service provider will be really helpful to follow and provide some good guidance for you. I don't have a hyperlink on here, but the Institute of Internal Auditors also just released a what they call a cybersecurity topical requirement as part of their new standards. And that is more of an organization-wide approach to cybersecurity, but there's a lot of really good information in there about best practices, governance, IT controls, and just a lot of other really good information that would be helpful for you to look at. So again, if you haven't seen that or you're not familiar with it, would definitely encourage you to take a look at the Institute of Internal Auditors cybersecurity topical requirements in addition to these resources below. But as I mentioned, I wanted to spend the next few minutes just going through these cybersecurity program best practices. So this document here is just a screenshot of the 12 best practices recommended by the Department of Labor or the DOL. So I'm going to go through these in detail here, just kind of starting with an overview of the best practices. So one of the first places to start is with policies, procedures, and I'll talk a little bit more about some specific high risk or high priority policies on the next couple of slides. But what I really wanted to focus on here was just these policy template links that I've included. Again, you'll receive a copy of the slide deck, so you'll have these hyperlinks. One of these is the SANS Institute. These are very basic templates over IT best practices. Again, they are very basic, pretty high level. They are free, but they are a great starting point if you don't have anything to build off of. Would also recommend reaching out to any plan administrators, managed service providers, or outside IT consultants to see if they also have templates that might be a little bit more customized to your organization's infrastructure. If not, there's also the ISACA policy toolkit that was just released in the last month or two, and that has very high quality templates. It does cost $50 for non-ISACA members, but they are very high quality. You know, both of these templates or sets of templates, or really any templates that you receive, are going to require some level of customization review. They may even require a baseline risk assessment or IT or cybersecurity assessment to properly customize them. But again, these should provide really good starting points for anybody who is working to improve upon their documentation or starting from scratch. So I've taken those 12 best practices from the Department of Labor screenshot a couple slides ago, and I've tried to just group them into three overarching categories. So this first one is over policies and procedures. So this first one is just to have a formal, well-documented cybersecurity program. And I think that's where the policy links on the last page I referenced are really going to be helpful. Formal policies, procedures covering all of the IT general controls at the organization, and then also specifically policies that address the policies, procedures over the retirement plan, if there is any sort of difference in control from accessing the retirement platform or for communicating with third-party administrators versus communicating or accessing other platforms within the organization. Within those policies, you should have clearly defined roles for information security policies. Again, delineating between what is done internally versus what you leverage a managed service provider or what you're reliant on your third-party administrator for. So that should be clearly addressed within your policies. Having strong access control procedures, doing a review of access rights, having onboarding and offboarding policies for all employees, and that'll kind of get into our next one as far as the onboarding process. But having cybersecurity awareness training as well. And sorry, jumping back to the access control procedures, I did just want to reference that link that I had provided, tips for your beneficiaries and plan participants. That will be really helpful in also providing more information or some best practice controls to implement into your access control policy. So also conducting periodic cybersecurity awareness training, onboarding, as well as annually, and doing ongoing phishing simulations to protect the organization. Also, if necessary, there may be a specific onboarding training when being incorporated into the retirement plan and being given access to the online platform. implement and manage a secured system development lifecycle. So essentially putting in place a process to continuously improve upon your cybersecurity practices. The encryption of sensitive data stored in transit should be specifically addressed. And then this last one is really just kind of an overall best practice to ensure strong technical controls in accordance with best security practices. So just staying abreast on industry updates, changes to regulation, new information coming out like those cybersecurity topical requirements from the IIA, and just making sure that you're staying on top of any new developments as it relates to cybersecurity and IT. The second category that I've grouped into is basic risk management practices. So performing annual risk assessments over your IT environment to identify potential vulnerabilities. This can also specifically address access controls or incident response items related specifically to issues encountered within the retirement plan. Having a reliable annual third-party audit of security controls. So bringing in an independent assessor to look at your security controls. And this also ties into the next comment, which is under item 6, to ensure that any assets or data stored in a cloud or managed by a third-party service provider are also subject to security reviews. So making sure that you're doing this internally over your own controls and processes, and that someone else is performing this over the third-party administrator. So one of the best practices we always recommend is to review the SOC reports that are performed over your third-party administrators. That SOC1 report will identify any kind of significant vulnerabilities or issues, control deficiencies that may lead to your organization maybe placing a particular emphasis on controls internally or following up with your third-party administrator to understand what the risks are to your organization or to your data. And if the issues or the vulnerabilities identified are significant enough, it may actually inform you that you may need to make a switch in your service provider. So reviewing those SOC reports is really helpful. And the last section is business resiliency and incident response. So having a defined program or process to follow up on any issues, small issues related to accessing accounts or lost user credentials, things like that, or bigger issues relating to the system going down or compromised data or a breach of your infrastructure or of the retirement platform. These should all be addressed, the roles and responsibilities involved in following up on these, remediating them, reporting on them if necessary, should all be clearly defined within those policies. If necessary, if your risk profile is high enough, it may actually be necessary to run tabletop scenarios over worst case scenarios, again, like a breach or a ransomware attack in which data out of your retirement plan becomes compromised. And any of these issues, no matter how small or how big, should be logged so that there is an audit trail of what the incident was, how it was remediated, what the response time was, and if there was any business impact or impact to your data. And then lastly, again, this one is kind of in line with number 9, but just appropriately responding to the cybersecurity incidents. So putting together an after action report to document what happened, why it happened, what has been done to prevent it from happening in the future, and assessing the potential business impact, really focusing on any kind of compromised data or personally identifiable information, since those are the highest risk assets within the retirement plan. And lastly, it's always important to just keep the board apprised on any of these cybersecurity updates, any issues that are encountered within these processes. SAS 145, which is a statement on auditing standards that went into effect for years, their fiscal years ending after December 15th, 2023, is a big one that we've been trying to educate our clients on. And this really emphasizes the kind of the same requirements of the DOL as to just having a well-documented and comprehensive cybersecurity program in place, supported by policies, procedures, processes, roles, and responsibilities. When reporting on these items to the board of directors, you know, IT, cybersecurity, it can be a very technical area, it can be a little overwhelming. So it's important to not use technical jargon, try to break it down in simplistic or layman's terms to focus on the high-risk areas. If you have dashboards available through any of your vulnerability assessments, cyber scans, or through your enterprise risk management program, those can easily be incorporated as board reporting tools. And if necessary, if you haven't kind of assigned or delegated this responsibility for IT cybersecurity risk management to the board or to a particular committee, it's always helpful to set this as a recurring agenda item for a particular committee if that maybe falls to the Finance and Audit Committee or to the full board, or if you have a specific IT steering committee, adding this as an agenda item and making sure that discussion, review, feedback is captured in the minutes is really important to just, again, making sure that you are staying on top of all of the high-risk items that could be impacting your organization at large, as well as the retirement plan specifically. So that's going to do it for my section on cybersecurity, and that will bring us to our first polling question. So just for informational purposes, we're curious, do you follow a specific framework for your IT or cybersecurity program? If so, feel free to select one of the ones below. If it's not presented, we've got the other option. Or if currently, you know, you're in a position where I think a lot of organizations we work with are, where currently they're relying on the managed service provider and the third-party administrator's policies and programs for their cyber controls. And if you're not sure, feel free to answer F. That will give everybody a few more seconds to answer. Looks like we got a lot of no, unsure, and a lot of we rely on our managed service provider, third-party administrator. Again, this is not a unique scenario. A lot of clients, a lot of organizations we work with are in a similar position. Would definitely recommend leveraging those managed service providers for any kind of policies, procedures they have. Ask them for strategic guidance on how to start your building your cybersecurity or IT program, how to formalize it. And if not, please always feel free to reach out to us with any questions that you may have. But with that, I will turn things over to Alejandra.
Thank you, Mac, and thank you, everyone. I am Alejandra Jensen. I'm one of the engagement partners at GRF, and I will be going over Secure Act 2.0 today. So again, this has been a hot topic, especially in the employee benefit plan community. It was passed back in December of 2022 by Congress under the Biden administration. And the ultimate goal of the act was to help Americans better prepare for retirement by getting people to save more, improving the retirement rules, and making it more cost-effective for setting up those retirement plans. Now, the act has over 90 provisions that will go into effect starting immediately through 2027. So we'll go through a little bit today on what's coming down the pipeline as far as you know, the effective dates for those provisions within the next year or so. Now, while some of these provisions are going into effect, some immediately, you do not need to make any formal plan amendments until the end of the first plan year, beginning on or after January 1, 2025. So again, no formal plan amendments needed until probably 2026. Under the provisions of Secure Act 2.0, you'll see that there's been some audit requirement changes that went into effect for your 2023 plan years. So under the previous guidance, you are required to undergo an audit if you had at least 100 eligible plan participants. And again, there was an exception on the 80-120 rule, which I'm not going to go into too much detail. But if you had 100 eligible plan participants or more, regardless if they had plan balances or not within the plan, you were still required to undergo an audit. Now, under the new guidance, and again, effective for your 2023 plan year, the plan is now required to undergo an audit if it has over 100 participants with an account balance at the beginning of the plan year. So again, a slight change there. I would say that at least on my side and the clients that I have, I think maybe only one or two didn't have to go undergo a plan audit this year because of the plan balances. So again, big change, the clapping here, because again, you know, they're trying to streamline things for to make it easier on the plan administrators. All right, moving forward with the key provisions of the Secure Act 2.0, there's a couple big ones that I want to mention here today. One on the required minimum distribution. So beginning January 1 of 2023, so the beginning of last year, they increased the required minimum distribution age to 73, and previously it was 70 and a half. So again, that's great news, because if you're heading into retirement and you don't need to tap into your retirement savings, you can benefit from the power of compounding. Again, if the market is favorable, you're going to be obviously increasing your plan benefits by keeping your funds within the plan for a longer period of time. Under the provisions of the Act, under Section 107, they're also going to further increase the age requirement to 75 by 2033. And then they have also decreased the penalty for not taking a required minimum distribution from 50% to 25%, or 10% if you correct the mistake within 2 years. And then additionally, starting in 2024, so starting this year, Roth accounts will be exempt from the required minimum distribution rules while the participant is still alive. So again, major changes as it relates to those required minimum distributions. Catch-up contributions, on the other hand, so currently, anyone over the age of 50 are able to make an additional $7,500 catch-up contribution starting January 1 of 2025. They're increasing that catch-up contribution to $10,000 annually for those between 60 and 63 years of age. Now, beginning in 2026, Section 603 of the Secure Act 2.0 states that any catch-up contributions to plans must go into Roth accounts in after-tax dollars if you are over the age of 50 and made over $145,000 in the prior year. Auto enrollment is another one that I want to go over. And again, this will be effective for plan years beginning after December 31, 2024. So again, effective for plan years in 2025. So we'll be requiring that new plans have an auto enrollment feature. So again, encouraging employees and participants to participate in the plans and starting them off with an auto deferral of either anywhere from 3 to 10%. There is an exclusion for any new companies less than 3 years old or companies with less than 10 employees. The other hot topic that came up, and especially we've attended a few employee benefit plan conferences this year already, and one of the hot topics is this, the long-term part-time employee rules. So any employees with 500 hours or more in a 2 consecutive 12-month period must be able to participate in the plan. Now you can exclude any long-term or part-time employees under the age of 21. And employer contributions are not required. So if you have a discretionary contribution or a safe harbor match that you are providing to your employees as a benefit, that does not necessarily mean that you also have to extend that to your long-term part-time employees. And then as a result of this, you would also be excluding them from your non-discrimination compliance testing. And again, this will be effective for plan years, the plan year that we're in now, so 2024. The next thing that was brought up is matching on student loan payments. So this is allowing student loan payments to be treated as elective deferrals for the purposes of matching contributions. So I think this is going to be used mainly with individuals, especially those that are right out of college that have the student loans. So, and maybe sometimes, they don't, money can only stretch so far, so they might not be able to defer into the plan. So this would allow them to take advantage of the employer provided matching contributions. So again, this would allow the participant to certify annually that a payment was made to their student loans. And they're allowed to claim this within 3 months after the plan year to take advantage of the matching contributions. It has to be offered to any eligible employee participating in the plan. And again, this is for effective for plan years after December 31, 2023. All right, moving on to the Savers Match Program. So this is another one that has been around for a while, but they're making some changes to it. Currently funded by the federal government, and the current law provides for a tax credit. And that tax credit comes in the form of cash as part of your tax refund when you're filing your tax return. So instead of doing that, now it's changing that to a federal matching contribution that would be deposited to the taxpayer's plan. So again, there would be a 50% match on contributions up to $2,000 per person. And there will be a phase out between $41,000 to $71,000 for joint filers, half for singles. And again, this would go into effect for 2027. One of the things that was brought up is, you know, the fact of just making sure, and I don't know how they're going to do this, on how the taxpayer is going to be disclosing, you know, the plan number, their account number, and all of that. So when we attended the conference last week, they were talking about some of the hiccups and things that they're going to have to iron out just to make sure that this can ultimately work. The next thing is the auto portability provision. So back in January of this year, the DOL announced the proposed regulation. The benefit here would be the fact that rolling over a retirement account to a new employer when you're changing jobs has been a source of frustration for participants in the past. So this would allow an automatic and seamless transfer. It would also reduce the rate of cash outs. So having that automatic portability, I think, is going to be a huge benefit, especially with the fact that, you know, people usually do usually change jobs frequently. And so under the provision, they're also increasing the minimum auto portability account value threshold from 5,000 to 7,000. So this one is still under the works, and they still have not finalized the regulation just yet. The next thing is the new distribution types that are allowed under Secure Act 2.0. The first one, the emergency expense distribution, that allows for a one in-service distribution a year for up to $1,000 to address any unforeseeable or immediate financial needs relating to necessary personal or family emergency expenses. And you can repay that within 3 years, and the participant can self-certify. And again, no penalties related to that distribution. There's another one, the disaster-related distribution, which allows distributions up to $22,000. And so that's available for any type of plan and can be applied to distributions reaching back to 2021. And again, this is repayable and in-service distribution to give individuals access as part of a recovery from a qualified federal disaster. And again, in order to qualify for that, the participant, their principal residence must be in a designated disaster zone. So something else to note there. There's also something, the domestic abuse related distribution, and that allows for in-service distributions of up to $10,000. And again, that's available for any distributions made after December 31, 2023. And you can also repay that within 3 years. The long-term care premium related distributions. So this is another one, and you can take up to $2,500 penalty free, and that's effective after December 29, 2025. There is extensive rules on what qualifies as an eligible long-term care insurance. So again, this one's coming down the pipeline for 2026. So that leads me into my polling question. That was kind of a high-level overview of Secure Act 2.0, what's coming down in the next few years, particularly focusing on 2024 and 2025. So for those of you on, have you formally amended your plan to comply with Secure Act 2.0? Yes, no, or unsure?
Hey, Alejandra, while people are answering the polling question, you have a question in the Q&A.
Oh, okay. I will
Take
double check.
Okay.
Is the student loan matching update required? There are some employees who are telling their employers they aren't participating. Yeah, so I think this is one where it's allowed. It is not required. So I would just double check with, you know, obviously your management team to determine if you want to offer that to your employees as a benefit. All right. So most of you said unsure or no. So again, you have until 2026 to formally amend your plan to comply with the provisions of SECURE Act 2.0, but just have it in your mindset moving forward.
Hey, Alejandra, we've got another question from Kara.
Yes, I do see that. So thank you, Kara. For all of the distributions, what happens if you don't pay those back? Are you incurring interest that must be repaid with the amount distributed? So yeah, so if you don't pay those back, I think there's probably going to be some sort of penalty or excise tax on those. But for the ones that you were able to repay within 3 years, yes, I think there will be some sort of penalty. Thank you for your question. All right, well, if there are other questions, I will hand it over to you, Susan.
Yeah, hand it to Sarah next, actually. Thanks, Alejandra.
Hi, everybody. My name is Sarah Glenn. I'm a senior audit manager here at GRF. And I'm going to review some of the Form 5500 updates that took place in 2023. The Form 5500 series is part of ERISA's overall reporting and disclosure framework, which is intended to ensure that all employee benefit plans are operated and managed in accordance with certain prescribed standards, and participants, beneficiaries, and regulators are provided with sufficient information to protect the rights and benefits of participants and beneficiaries under the employee benefit plan. The DOL, IRS, and PBGC jointly developed the Form 5500 series so employee benefit plans could satisfy annual reporting requirements under ERISA and the Internal Revenue Code. The schedules and instructions are available on the DOL ERISA website. The DOL EBSA made some changes to the Form 5500, which went into effect on January 1, 2023. The following slides that I'll review will highlight some of those changes that will be shown on the 2023 Form 5500. The first slide addresses the participant account methodology, which Alejandra sort of reviewed in the previous slides. The number of the participants with account balances at the beginning of the year will now be used to account participants. The change will affect lines 5 and 6 in part 2 of the Form 5500. Before, as Alejandra mentioned, the individuals were considered participants of the plan when they satisfied the plan age and service requirements for participation, even if they elected not to participate in the plan. So this may affect some plans that were being, like Alejandra mentioned, that maybe had needed a requirement for an audit based on having over 100 participants, but now based on the change, they might have less than 100 participants and may not require an audit. The next slide addresses a change regarding consolidated Form 5500 reporting options. For certain groups of defined contribution retirement plans, a defined contribution group is treated as a new type of direct filing entity. To be eligible to file a consolidated Form Group 5500 as a DCG, a group plan must 1, have the same plan administrator, 2, the same fiduciaries, 3, the same trustee, 4, the same plan year, and 5, the same investment or investment options. They will report the specific plan level information on the new scheduled DCG for each individual plan that is in the DCG, including an auditor's report for each plan. Each plan participating in the DCG must individually complete a scheduled DCG that would be filed with the Form 5500. Schedule DCG Part 6 addresses compliance questions, including timeliness of remittance, non-exempt transactions, and related party interests, and the fidelity bond coverage. These are the same questions that are on the Schedule R, which the DCG plan is not required to complete. The Schedule DCG Plan 7 is the accountant is will address the accountant opinion information for the participating plans. A DCG participating plan must be audited by an IQPA report and an audited financial statement for the participating plans, Schedule DCG. The audit and the report must follow the same rules as required for a plan that has filed its own annual Form 5500 and annual 5500 return. Another change is the Schedule MEP, Multi-Employer Retirement Plan information. This schedule improves the reporting for those multi-employer plans and includes pooled employer plans. The Schedule MEP is added to the Form 5500 and it consists of three parts. Preparers are required to attach a list of participating employer information in accordance with the Form's 5500 instructions. Also, a new box is checked that will note that on the Form 5500 that the Schedule MEP is attached. Some additional changes to the Form 5500, which I'd like to mention, is one. First off is the Schedule 8H under administrative expenses. This group is now broken out into further detail to provide the reader with more information on what's included in those administrative expenses on the Schedule H. Also, there's further improvements in the financial and funding reporting by the PBGC covering those defined benefit plans. Like I sort of mentioned earlier, there's a change to the Schedule R reporting requirements related to the type of plan. Schedule R now includes several new IRS tax compliance questions that concern three major areas: one, non-discrimination testing; two, the ADP testing; and three, the pre-approved plan letters. This is all included in Part 8 of the Schedule R. And also, based on the type of plan, other parts of the plan will need to be completed. And you will be able to see on this next slide, it gives you some examples of, based on the type of plan, what additional parts will need to be completed. Lastly, I wanted to mention is in Part 2, Line 8A and Line 8B, address characteristic codes. Each code has both a number and a letter designated base, which has different identifiers related to special features of the plan. These codes are very important to review. There have been some changes to the codes, and then some codes have been added, especially ones related to 403 plans. So it's important to review these codes before you do your filing. Codes that do not comply with the plan might result in a rejection of your Form 5500 or a notice of some issues related to your plan. Then one thing I want to cover is in the last slide is related to personal identifiable information. This is more of just a reminder that has been addressed in some of the CPEs we've attended related to findings by the DOL. The Form 5500 instructions specifically indicate that personal information should not be included with the filing because the Form 5500 is a public document. DOL has identified numerous Form 5500 filings containing personal information, and plan administrators run the risk of their Form 5500 filing being rejected and or civil penalties being assessed based on the personal information included in those filings of the 5500. So we recommend that before the Form 5500 is filed to review to make sure there's no personal information. Examples would be Social Security numbers, credit card information, financial account information, passport numbers, anything like that. And so now I'm going to go to the next polling question. Are you ensuring that removal of personal information from your Form 5500 was performed? And the questions are either from a sponsor, either yes, no, or unsure. Okay. Well, you see, there's a lot of unsure, so that's something you could just sort of make, we all will note before we do our filings to go through and make sure there's no personal information included in your returns. And next, I'm going to hand it over to Susan.
Thanks, Sarah. So I don't know how many people know this, but the Form 5500 is available publicly online. The DOL has a searchable database. It's on the EBSA eFast website. So if you didn't know that, then that's one of the reasons why they're really pushing this, being careful about what the PII is in that 5500 filing. Because it is available to the public, sort of like your 990 is available on GuideStar. So I'm going to do the next section and bring us home to the end of the webinar. My section is about what's on the horizon. There's a couple things on the horizon, and then there's also a couple other things that are just sort of other items to note. So sort of a hodgepodge of things here. So I'm going to talk about a new auditing standard that's effective this year, SAS 147, related to inquiries of the predecessor auditor regarding fraud and non-compliance with laws and regulations. The acronym for that is NOCLAR, for some reason. That's what they're calling it. I don't know why that makes sense, but that's what it's being called. The next two bullet points of topics that I'm going to go over with you guys relate to some proposed changes the DOL has made. The comment period for these proposed changes ended in April, but these are proposed changes that are likely to be finalized related to the Voluntary Fiduciary Correction Program and the prohibited transaction exemption. I'm also going to give you a little intel on the new IRS program for obtaining a determination letter for your 403B plan. And then also some guidance from AICPA's FinRec on how to record and report defined contribution DC plan contributions receivable. There's been a little bit of difference among plans on how that's been done. So there's some guidance out there now. So that's what I'm going to go over. And I'm going to move on. So the first thing is this new SAS 147 auditing standard, which is effective now. So for your, if you're a calendar year end 2023 plan year, if you have a switch in auditors, your auditors are now required to make inquiries of the previous auditors. And those inquiries must include asking about fraud and matters involving NOCLAR. And the predecessor auditors are also now, under the new standard, required to respond to those inquiries. So I think previous standards had sort of mentioned that auditors were supposed to ask about fraud, but there was no necessarily requirement to specifically ask about identified and suspected fraud and NOCLAR. So that's a little bit of a change from the successor auditor's perspective. From the predecessor auditor's perspective, the change is that now they're required to respond, whereas in previous standards, it was more along the lines of, they say none noted, and there really wouldn't be any further discussion after that. So if they had identified something or suspected something, then they didn't necessarily have to tell us about it if we were the successor auditor. So that's an interesting change. And now, successor auditors, once they've determined that they're going to accept the audit client, will have to document that in their work papers that they've done that inquiry and what the results of the inquiry were. So it's an interesting little shift there. All right. So next up is the DOL proposal that was released in November of 2022. About these two next slides, this one related to the Voluntary Fiduciary Correction Program and the other one related to prohibited transactions. The comment period ended in April, and then the DOL plans to notify the public of the final regulation in a subsequent Federal Register document. But in all likelihood, these two proposed changes are going to take effect. So here's a little bit about what's going on. So the Voluntary Fiduciary Correction Program will have a self-correction component added to it, which is nice because, if a plan administrator has a need to do a self-correction, now they can go into this and take care of it without having to worry about the DOL coming after them to do it. So this actually expands the types of transactions that will be covered under the program, the VFCP, sorry. It's going to add conditions for self-correction of delinquent contributions and loan repayments. So the correction must take place within 180 days from the date of withholding or the plan's receipt of the contribution, and lost earnings cannot exceed $1,000. So you have to be in compliance with those two things in order to take advantage of the self-correction option. Self-correcting plans will be required to use the online calculator to determine the lost earnings, and also use an online portal to file the notice of correction with the DOL. And then once you've done all that, you need to complete and retain the self-correction retention record checklist. And that helps you to document what happened, what you did, and whatnot, so that if any DOL representatives question what happened, then you can pull that out and show them what happened. So that's the update on that, adding self-correction to the VFCP. I'm going to move to the next one related to prohibited transactions. So this is a proposed amendment to PTE 2002-51, prohibited transaction class exemption. This amendment will allow an employer to obtain excise tax relief for self-corrected late contributions meeting certain conditions. There's a big emphasis on this self-correction stuff. The DOL wants people to come forward and just take care of these issues and not be afraid to admit that there was a mistake and we're going to move on and make the plan whole. So these are new programs that are trying to encourage that a little bit more. They already have such programs in place for some other things, but they're expanding some of this stuff. So self-correcting plans would notify the DOL that a correction has taken place, again, using an online portal. The DOL is getting really digital on us, which is kind of nice. It'll make things more efficient. Interestingly, right now, employer-sponsored plans are currently only allowed to apply for one voluntary correction every 3 years. But this proposed change will eliminate the cap on the total number of voluntary corrections that the agency will process for a single plan. So again, they're trying to expand the reach of self-correction, so encouraging people to come forward and just fix things before the DOL makes an issue of it. So that's kind of a nice thing. I don't see any questions, so I'm going to keep motoring on. So here we go. This next one is interesting. So I'm not going to say how many years ago it was, but back in 2009, when 403B plans were first kind of swooped up into the audit requirement, a lot of these 403B plans did not have determination letters from the IRS. And usually with a defined contribution plan, like a 401k, the IRS would issue a determination letter to say, hey, your plan is qualified, a qualified plan, and therefore it can operate and provide employees the tax deferral option. So 403B plans were sort of kind of the Wild West for a while, until the audit requirement kicked in 2009. And then shortly thereafter, the IRS opened up a 403B determination letter program because they realized that these plans didn't have these letters. And then they quickly shut it down because I think they got inundated with requests for determination letters from these plans. And so what's happened is a couple of years by, and now we're seeing the IRS come back to this and open up a program whereby these plans can now get these determination letters. But the way the IRS is rolling it out is interesting. So if you're a plan sponsor with an EIN ending in 1, 2, or 3, you could apply for a determination letter effective June 1 of 2023. So that started last year for those plan sponsors. And then if you have an EIN ending in 4, 5, 6, or 7, you can apply for a determination letter on June 1st of 2024. So that happens this year. And then next year, everyone else gets swooped in and can apply for a determination letter on June 1 of 2025. So by the time it's all said and done, all the 403B plans will be allowed to obtain a determination letter and have that in their file. And then if your 403B plan is terminating, you can request a plan termination letter no matter what, and you don't have to wait for the EIN rollout. So you can do that anytime now if the plan is terminating. So it's a pretty interesting little program that's going on. Thanks, Mac. We'll see ya. All right. I'm going to move. Oops, too far. Went too far. Go back. Go back. All right. Last item on my slides relates to the guidance from the AICPA's Financial Reporting Executive Committee, or FINREC. So defined contribution plans have been treating employer and employee receivables on the plan a little bit differently. So one plan might record a contribution receivable based on when the service was performed, not necessarily when the contribution was withheld from the employee. And other plans were recording the contribution receivable on the plan based on the period in which the contribution was withheld. You know, there was no one right way to do this. And because of the disparities in practice, FINREC has provided some guidance around this. They're not saying one way is better than the other, but what they are saying is establish a policy for how you're going to do your accrual for your contributions receivable, apply it consistently, and disclose it in the plan's financial statements so readers know how you're recording that receivable. So that's the scoop on the guidance from FINREC, which I actually welcome because I always wondered about that. So that's the end of the hodgepodge of things that I was going to talk about. And I'm going to bring up the polling question for my section. If you have a 403B plan, are you excited about being able to get a determination letter for your plan? Yes, no, unsure, or not applicable are the answers. Kind of curious to see what y'all think. So I don't have the ability to see the poll, but hopefully everyone else can. And let me see if there are any questions. Oh, here's the poll. Haha. So unsure or NA. And some of us are excited. That's awesome. All right. Very good. Thank you all. We appreciate your participation. Let me double check the time. It's 11:53. It's a little early, but I'm not seeing any questions in the chat. So I'm going to go ahead and bring us home. Unless anyone has any unanswered or burning questions. Oh, hi, Jessica. Jessica says, are determination letters required for all 403B plans? I think you should get a determination letter for your 403B plan. I'm not sure they're required, but I would think that it's highly encouraged to get one. You might want to check in with your TPA and see what they think. But since the IRS is offering the program now, as an auditor of benefit plans, I would prefer my 403B plans to get a determination letter because that makes me feel more comfortable that it's actually a qualified plan under the IRS rules. So hopefully that answers your question. Awesome. Very good. All right. Am I missing any, Alejandra? I think you were going to tell me about that one.
No, I don't see any others that have come through. Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks. All right, folks. So let's bring it home. Let me go back to this. So thanks for attending the webinar today. We encourage you to follow us on social media at GRFCPAs and visit our website for upcoming events and alerts. Please remember to complete the survey that will appear automatically following our session here if you want to earn the CPE credit. And thanks again for joining us. We appreciate it. Do I have a question in the chat here? Yes, the slides will be emailed out. We'll definitely provide you with the slides. All right. I'm going to let you all go now. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening to the GRF On The Go podcast. Visit our website at grfcpa.com for more information about the services we provide, the industries we serve, or to request a quote.